I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. In the 2 years since the Me Too movement took hold, has our capacity to tolerate indiscretion or even crime bottomed out? Has the pendulum swung from resignation and silence to a culture of boycotts and public call-outs in social media? Cancel culture often targets people in the public eye who have engaged in inappropriate behavior or shared an unpopular opinion about race, ethnicity, gender, or sexuality. When comedian Shane Gillis was fired from SNL after videos of his using racist language surfaced, many asked if it's time to cancel culture. Dr. Sherry Parks joins me to talk about backlash abounding, from the New York Times to the Joker movie. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Today, it's Midday Culture Connections with our good friend, Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. Good to see you, Sherry.
Hi there.
So today, we're going to talk about the phenomenon known as cancel culture. Shane Gillis almost hit it big. He was hired to be on SNL. But after videos of the comedian using racial slurs surfaced on the internet, he was fired before he even started. Many have lobbed criticism at the media, citing an obsession with call-out culture and political correctness that has gone too far. And maybe in a way, Shane Gillis has hit it big anyway. David Dennis is a writer and professor of journalism at Morehouse College. He asserts that cancel culture itself is a myth. He says that the phrase is being wielded as a weapon to silence marginalized minorities in order to protect those in positions of power. So is cancel culture the apex of political correctness gone mad, or are we witnessing the long overdue societal shunning of behaviors and ideas that are steeped in generations of racial and gender inequity? Sherry Parks does join me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us on email, on Twitter, or on the phone, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. So just as an overview, do you see this as a pendulum, you know, where we swung too far left or too far right or too far in either direction when it comes to the shaming that people have to endure on social media when it's discovered that they've done things that in many cases even they regret? How do you place where we are in terms of this backlash and cancel culture as it's come to be known?
I don't think of it as left or right, because the shaming happens on both sides. But it's, your pendulum example is interesting, because this is really about social media. And in the old days, if you got a letter, if you're in the media, if you ran a TV station, or you got a letter, the truism was that represented 500 people. And now all those voices can come to you directly, so that it's much busier. As you, I'm sure, witnessed, that when you, if you say something, you don't say a lot of things that are outrageous, but if someone said something that was outrageous, you'd hear from a lot of people. And we don't know how to measure that. We don't know if each of those still represents 500 people, so we know how many people, but we do know that loud people can create this consensus that pushes people one way or the other. It also does allow, particularly Twitter, has allowed previously marginalized voices to come to the center. Twitter, Black Twitter, can be wonderful, it can be vicious, and that's true of other pieces.
Yeah, people have called it out as examples of mob behavior. No, I mean, not Black Twitter in particular, right, but just Twitter in general, as mob behavior, online shaming that you would never encounter in real life. I mean, I try not to say outrageous things. I try to say things that are true.
That's what I thought.
However, I've been criticized on Twitter. I've been called a racist. I've been called a, you know, communist. I've been called ultra-liberal, too conservative. I mean, people call me things all the time. I mean, I wonder if, you know, if they encounter me at a dinner party, would they say, oh, by the way, you're a racist? You know?
Well, of course not, because if you do that to someone in person, they have the opportunity to hit back at you. I mean, you can do that on social media, but is it worth your time to do that? But in a social situation, you would almost immediately, you know, correct that impression. And so that lack of retribution is a huge part of it. And, you know, we'll get into this, but a lot of this really is the culture trying to self-correct. Culture is kind of like a rubber band, and it'll always try to snap back. Notice that word back, to, you know, someone is too racist, too tall, too short, to, you know, and the culture will try to push you back into its old equilibrium, even if that equilibrium wasn't fair to everybody.
Does the proximity to the behavior matter, in that if in the case of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of somebody here off the top of my head, you know, who did terrible things 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I mean, even in the political arena, people are condemning Joe Biden, and as they did in the last cycle, condemned Hillary Clinton for their support of the 1995 omnibus crime bill, which they said led to mass incarceration, right? And one of the answers to that is, well, look, that was 20 years ago. We've learned a lot since then, and we've even had some contrite apologies about it. But in the case of this guy, Shane Gillis, he's a comedian. It was just last year, 2018, that he had this podcast, which he called Matt and Shane's Secret Podcast. And he said all sorts of terrible things. I mean, really, really terrible things about Asian people, Chinese people in particular. It wasn't even mildly funny, at least to my ears. And I'm, you know, I'm a person, I think, who enjoys a pretty good joke now and then. I mean, I don't think I'm a prude, but and when SNL fired him, they basically said, we were not aware of this. And had we been aware of these comments, we would never have hired him. And they faulted themselves for a bad vetting process. What do you think about the fact that this happened last year, or even that it happened at all with this guy?
Well, it does make me wonder about what their vetting process was that everybody else found and they didn't. But, I mean, what you pulled out are a couple of things. There is a compression of time. I mean, when you said proximity, you weren't talking about space. You were talking about time.
Time, yeah,
that,
yeah, yeah.
That in the old days, that it would have been hard to find things that were 20 years. Somebody would have had gone into the archives and pulled it out. And now we can Google it, and things pop up. And so what you did as a, and I hope young people are listening to this, what you did as a young person is much more readily available. You know, we're in this interesting moment right now. I mean, certainly in the last 20 years with humor, we were into a almost anything goes, you know, oh yeah, and which is funny, like, oh yeah, I get to curse in public. And you get a humor response from that, as you pointed out, even though there's no humor work going on other than that. And now, and I've been predicting this for a while now, that we are moving more toward a social responsibility government where you cannot yell fire in a theater. And legally that's been the case. But now what counts for yelling fire is getting more and more broad and looking more like European countries, where there's much more concern about the effect of an utterance than there has been heretofore. I mean, you said all that a minute ago. I'm just pulling it apart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for example, in this podcast, Gillis says, an Asian trying to learn English bothers me more than someone listening to, like, Lil Uzi Vert while I'm trying to eat dinner. Now, I don't know who Lil Uzi Vert is. Lil Uzi Vert. I have no idea who that is. It's a rapper, I guess, right? But, you know, an Asian person trying to learn English bothers you? I mean, that's just, I don't get the joke, first of all, and why would it bother you? And, of course, then he says in a tweet, this is Mr. Gillis, it feels ridiculous for comedians to be making serious public statements, but here we are. I'm a comedian who was funny enough to get SNL. That can't be taken away. Of course, I wanted the opportunity to prove myself, but I understand it would be too much of a distraction. I respect the decision they made. I'm honestly grateful for the opportunity. I was always a mad TV guy anyway. Ha ha ha.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because, you know, humor researchers will tell you that there's often a germ of whatever that person thinks is truth in there. And there's often, as an African-American, I'm sensitive to this, a repositioning of African-Americans and African-American culture vis-a-vis other supposedly immigrant groups. You don't have to be an immigrant to be Asian. But that kind of, I'd rather this thing that is associated with Black culture than this thing that is associated with Asians is a repositioning of what David Duke has called our native minorities, by which he means me, not indigenous people.
Yeah, yeah, he's not talking about Native Americans.
Right,
yeah,
right, right. And so that and saying something outrageous, supposedly, about model minorities, notice, I mean, it's not funny, you're right, but the humor comes from, oh my God, he said that about Asians.
Yeah, it's interesting. And of course, you know, I tell all sorts of jokes that bomb. I mean, that happens to me all the time. I've actually even done some stand-up comedy where I've been purposely trying to be funny to a particular group, and it's a lot harder than it looks.
It's
difficult. Sherry Parks is my guest. It's Midday Culture Connections. It's Midday with, as I said, Dr. Sherry Parks. And our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to the phones to Danny in Edgewood.
Hi, thank you very much for having this show and talking about this. I don't know if you ever saw the movie White Chicks by the Wayans Brothers or any of Eddie Murphy's comedy routines where he's in whiteface, or if you saw Idiocracy, which tells me that, you know, it is, I love to see people laughing about ethnic and racial differences, because as long as it's not full of vitriolic, as racists never find race to be funny, it's always a matter of hate. I think laughter is what joins us, and we have to be careful not to squash brilliant comedians pointing out our stupid things we do, the stupid ideas we have, and making us laugh at ourselves. Everybody should laugh at themselves. Thank you very much. I'll get off now.
All right, thanks. I appreciate that call, and I wonder if Danny thought that Mr. Gillis's remarks about, you know, an Asian person trying to learn English bothers him, if that was funny or not. That's an interesting thing.
Well, and humor actually is protected speech. I mean,
sure,
the comedians can get away with saying a lot of things that a journalist can't. But the First Amendment does not protect you from consequences. It doesn't protect you from the backlash of people being upset. And people do learn attitudes from humor. All of that is true. All of that is true.
Let's go to Angela in Mount Vernon. Angela, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Yes, thank you. I guess this kind of is a good piggyback off of the last comment. You know, we all have these shortcomings. We all have prejudices. We all tend to say things either in our echo chambers or sometimes in public at large that are incorrect. Most of us don't have these grand soapboxes upon which to stand, but you know, it's very easy for us as human beings to point the finger and to lay blame and shame. And I'm wondering if you can give everyone some tips on how to promote more honest conversations and opportunities to learn from one another, how these comments and behaviors hurt, and how we can build bridges instead of just laying blame and leaving it there. I mean, we have to point out, we should point out when people say things that are hurtful and that are damaging, but that shouldn't be the end of the conversation. So could you give us some tips on how we can promote more meaningful and evolutionary conversations? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that comment, Angela.
Oh, first, I would
You're the teacher, Dr. Parks.
Yes,
right.
<first, laughs> I would be very careful about the use of humor, because there are a lot of traps. And American humor is very full of ridicule. So sometimes we ridicule and we don't even realize we're ridiculing people. And so humor is very dangerous. I think candid conversations, that's a good way of saying it, is asking a question and realizing that your viewpoint is not almost ever the universal viewpoint, and being open to the fact that somebody may have seen something completely different than you every day. You know, Chimamanda Adichie warns of the danger of the single story. And I think that's really important, that there are multiple stories and multiple viewpoints. And even if you don't agree with them, you can recognize the logic of someone else. I think that's where it starts.
Yeah. And of course, one of the issues here, as you mentioned, there are consequences to certain behaviors. So if Mr. Gillis, the consequence for him is he doesn't get to be on SNL. The consequence for You know, a guy like Kevin Plank during the last presidential election cycle made some positive comments about Donald Trump. It actually hurt the stock price of mm-hmm. Under Armour. I mean, people decide I'm not going to shop at Home Depot because the guy who's running Home Depot supports the president and I don't wish to support his business. People make those decisions. They vote with their feet and they vote with their wallets. So that's part of the consequence. So, you know, a comedian can make the determination to say, you know, I'm not going to say something like this about Asian people or Black people or Indigenous people because it will get enough people mad that it's going to wreck my brand and it's going to impede my ability to get work.
And what's different now are two things that I think you just talked about. One, we know so much more now. I mean, I remember when the first book came out that said this is the politics of the people that you buy from. And it was a big deal because before we thought of corporations as being politically neutral. And I actually think the smart ones, you know, actually work at being neutral. And that we are much quicker to act. Do you remember the old days of boycotts? They were physical things you got on the street. We can do that now with the touch of a button. We know that activism of all sorts can be with the touch of a button. It's just much easier. So people react and feel they have the right to react. And that is different because the old equilibrium was based on silences. And I'm not saying that everything that everybody says now is great. I'm just pointing out that there were silences and unknowing presence before, where now we are no longer innocent.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The silences, yeah, and how that contrasts with what we hear. Because boy, Twitter don't seem too silent
no,
to me.
No, it is not.
Dr. Sherry Parks joins me here in Studio A. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at MICA and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. By the way, unrelated to anything, this quick reminder about our series called Midday in the Neighborhood. We're trying to hear from folks who are active in their neighborhood. So if you are out there doing things to better your community, please send us your contact information so that we can invite you to be on the show at some point. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org and one of our producers will be in touch. We will have more of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks when we return. After a quick break, 410-662-8780. Again, the email midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Perspectives on Impeachment. For the first time, polling shows slightly more than half of Americans support the inquiry into President Trump, while the other half doesn't see anything wrong with Mr. Trump's interaction with the president of Ukraine last summer in that now famous phone call. So we'll explore what we know so far and what's ahead as Congress continues this historic inquiry. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're talking about cancel culture. This week, it was reported that Warner Brothers Studios has disinvited the press from the U.S. premiere of the much-anticipated film Joker. The movie, which is the first ever film to focus solely on the deranged clown and iconic DC Comics villain, has forced the film's director, Todd Phillips, and the lead actor, Joaquin Phoenix, to defend the project over criticism that the film is overly sympathetic to the incel culture and white male violence. The film hits theaters nationwide this weekend. So what do you think? Has culture and cancel culture gone too far? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So as you understand it, Sherry, when it comes to this movie, The Joker, or Joker, I guess is the official title, what's the objection to it? Do you know?
Well, the objection is that the Joker, who's a well-known character from comic books and film, is a psychopath, right? And in this movie, we get to see a sympathetic portrayal. The filmmakers said they were trying to make a real movie with a comic book character, which I think is problematic because of the dictates of those different genres. But What has happened is, like, for instance, the people who were in the movie theater in Aurora, which was a Batman movie, have been upset about this. The military has issued some warnings about this. Now, keep in mind what I said about the culture trying to regain its equilibrium. The sympathetic treatment of a psychopath is something that the culture generally does not tolerate. And so they're hitting back against that portrayal.
And the director of the movie, this guy Todd Phillips, I guess is his name, and this is a movie, by the way, it received an 8-minute standing ovation at the Venice Film Festival. Mm. People in the movie business and in that community think this is a really good movie. It's a really well-made movie. We're going to talk about it, by the way, Thursday here on this program when we do our midday at the movies. But Joaquin Phoenix walked out of an interview after somebody asked him whether Joker could inspire real-life copycats. Seems to me that's an old argument, too. Do video games, you know, lead to mm-hmm. violence? Does mm-hmm. violence in movies lead to violence? And he says that Phillips, the director, bemoans the fact that it's not just the people on the right who are saying, oh, you know, political correctness has reached a peak and, you know, we're all too silly about political correctness. He's saying it's the people on the left. And he says outrage is a commodity. That's an interesting observation.
Well, I actually do think it's an interesting observation, and I agree that it can be. Let me back up to something that you alluded to, that comic books are full of really outsized characters, and there's an audience that knows how to read that. Comic book readers are actually much more literate and much more interesting in the tropes of the genre than people who don't know that culture would think. Then when you jump that to film, you've got a much larger, much more popular culture audience who's used to these dichotomies between good and bad. And it's interesting because in Europe...
Yeah, it's always the triumph over evil in these movies, right?
Right, right. And in Europe, I mean, their narratives often have a lot more gray area, and they've dealt with, a psychopath, with Hitler in ways that we never had to in this country, at least at that scale. So I think the audiences are very different. But the idea of outrage as a commodity is, I think, really interesting. And I had this conversation years ago with a well-known black feminist who would, get these fees to come and beat up on white people. And I had a conversation.
Nice work if you can get it, right?
Right. It's like, why are you letting her do that? And why is she doing it? And she said, and this is why I'm not saying who it is, she said, it's a gig. That idea of outrage being commodified does happen.
You think of somebody like Ann Coulter.
Right.
Who seems to be reasonably intelligent, but she just goes out there to be Ms. Outrage.
To provoke.
She's just a provocateur.
She's honest about that, that's her role is mm-hmm. to bother people and provoke them. I don't want that to become a dismissive statement that all outrage is a commodity, because there are lots of things to be outraged about that are legitimate. And some people commodify it. Almost anything in the media sphere becomes a commodity. But that doesn't mean that real people can't have real outrage and speak to it.
Dr. Sherry Parks is here. It's Midday Culture Connections. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @midday_wypr as well. Susan is on email who says, political correctness and overly protected speech really do not make for much humor. So Lenny Bruce would never make it on SNL today. What a shame. This commodification of outrage, I think you can take a look at the example of Donald Trump and his political rise, which didn't happen in the 2016 presidential cycle. I mean, that political rise started a lot longer before that. But it's there, the Washington Post wrote about the entire cottage industry devoted to people who are upset by the idea of others being outraged. So we have Trump playing to the outrage of his base, his vaunted base we hear so much, and then a whole industry devoted to people saying, that's outrageous.
Being outraged by the outrage.
By the outrage, right. Yeah.
And what gets missing there is the nuance and the intelligent conversation, because the outrage becomes the thing.
What about the punishment fitting the crime? I mean, Roseanne Barr got kicked off her TV show for tweets that she issued that were racist. Kevin Hart, according to a lot of reports, the one thing he really wanted to do in his life was host the Oscars. And they found some homophobic tweets in his past. All of a sudden, he's not hosting the Oscars. Now, Mr. Hart is not hurting financially. I mean, it's not like he's got nothing else to do. They haven't shunned him from Hollywood or from movies or from stand-up. Louis C.K., you know, his management dumped him. He gets iced out of Hollywood, made a movie that's never going to get released because of his sexual predations on various colleagues in the comedy industry. How do we determine whether those are fair consequences or not for that kind of behavior?
Well, losing a show is not losing your life. I mean, it's not going to prison. We often are much lighter on people of privilege than we are people who are disenfranchised in terms of the punishment. So loss of reputation is treated almost as if it were a prison sentence when it really isn't. And so I think we have to kind of keep that in perspective, that loss of. But notice how all the examples that you pulled out, most of all the examples we have in our public sphere, are about bias and power, because that's the stand-in for evil now. I mean, there are lots of ways to be evil, but that's almost our code word for evil now.
And misusing power is evil. Now, is it a misuse of power to say, I'm Louis C.K., so I'm going to invite these unsuspecting women to my dressing room and then do crude acts, sexual acts?
Of course.
You know, it is of course, right? Is Roseanne Barr misusing her power as a celebrity by sending out racist tweets? And in what way is that a misuse? In that is because she's a celebrity, would she have the capacity to convince other people to be racist?
Well, I mean, you're asking how celebrity works in this country. And to some degree, yes. I mean, that celebrity stands as, I'm saying this as an academic, that celebrity now stands in for knowledge. That people follow the celebrities that they care about. Notice I just switched to an emotional response. And follow them, and it almost becomes, for some people, and this goes back to your when you talked about video games and violence, it's not true for the masses, but for some people, that what that celebrity says carries some weight. But in the marketplace, the network gets to decide whether it wants to be associated with that or not, because not only, and this is really important, not only do racial minorities care, but a large number of white people care. Because they don't want to be associated with racism.
Then you have comedians like Jerry Seinfeld, who's refusing, who and has now for some years refused to play college campuses because he thinks kids in your industry, in academia, are too overly sensitive. You can't tell a joke anymore. Everybody is covetous of their safe spaces. And he says, I'm just not going to fool with that anymore.
Well, I want to go back to something that a caller suggested, that you couldn't do humor without insulting people. I mean, insult and ridicule are a certain type of humor. There are other types of humor that are funny without offending some people. We have overused offensive humor in our public sphere.
That speaks to the notion of intention. What you're trying to do. Are you trying to belittle people of another ethnicity or gender or class or race? We have a pretty long clip. Stick with us here. This is George Carlin talking to Larry King about a comedian named Andrew Dice Clay. He was very controversial at the time of this interview, which I guess was in the 90s or the early 2000s. Clay was the biggest stand-up act in America. And of course, his whole act was premised in misogyny and homophobia and racism. So here's this exchange that went between George Carlin, who's in many people's views one of the top five comedians in the history of comedy.
I would defend to the death his right to do everything he does. The thing that I find unusual, and it's not a criticism so much, but his targets are underdogs. And comedy traditionally has picked on people in power, people who abuse their power. Women and gays and immigrants are kind of, to my way of thinking, underdogs. And he ought to be careful because he's Jewish. And a lot of the people who want to pick on these kind of groups, the Jews are on that list a little further. You got women, gays, gypsies, blah, 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 blah. And then suddenly you find Jews. And Andrew,
suddenly Andrew's arrested.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, obviously he should do what he wants. And
why does he get away with it, do you think, then? Well, we have never laughed at jokes about the
Well,
poor.
He's appealing. I think he's appealing largely. I think his core audience are young white males who are threatened by these groups. I think a lot of these guys aren't sure of their manhood because that's a problem when you're going in through adolescence. You know, am I really? Am I? Could I be? I hope I'm not one of them. And the women who assert themselves and are competent are a threat to these men, and so are immigrants in terms of jobs and the
so that's why we as an audience then will laugh.
I don't think you're.
I mean,
either,
I don't know. But I mean, think you're collectively.
I think that's what is at the core of that experience that takes place in these arenas. Is a certain, a sharing of anger and rage at these targets. And I'm sure Andrew isn't that angry at them. I'm sure he's playing it as a comic.
That's interesting, isn't it? That George Carlin assumes, oh, Andrew's actually a really nice person. He holds no bias or prejudice against, you know, gays and women and people of color. He's just doing, as you say, it's a gig. How do you know that? I mean, when I heard Andrew Dice Clay, he never rang my chimes. It's not because I'm some goody two shoes. I'm like Mr. Non-Racist or something. It's none of that. But it just didn't work. And I was not at all convinced that his the disaffection or the unaffection for these various groups that he pilloried wasn't sincere.
I think if someone handed you a script that had racist humor, you would say, I'm not going to read this. I'm not going to read this to this audience. The fact that...
I wouldn't read it to any audience.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But my point is that even in... We do things, and we often do things about, you know, attitudes that are not purposefully intentional, that maybe he didn't step on the stage and say, I am going to pillory these groups. That doesn't mean the message isn't there and that as a professional, he's not responsible for the tools that he uses, for the type of humor he uses. You know, there's a whole field on humor research. So if someone wants to understand the different types of humor, they can.
There are doctoral dissertations to be read.
Oh, you betcha.
Let's go to the phones to John in Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi. Y'all have kind of covered the comment I want to make already, but in various ways. But just to, I guess, sew it all up, like we're talking about punching up versus punching down here in general. And I don't know. I just feel like in this day and age, like, why bother punching down? It's boring. It's been done. You just played a clip of George Carlin about Andrew Dice Clay from like over 15 years ago. Like if nothing else, like just get new material. If you want to look at it from like a comedy standpoint, this joke's already been told, you know, like, and, more to the point, like I said, it's boring. Like we're at a point now where you're taking a bigger risk, I guess, in a career, probably by speaking up against somebody rather than punching down. You're taking a risk with your career if you're gonna make fun of somebody, you know, for their race or their ethnicity, their religion, any of that stuff. You're taking a risk. Why not take a risk doing something a little bit more boldly? I don't know. That's just my opinion, but I'm not a comedian.
Well, thanks for that comment, John. I appreciate it. I mean, he's talking to the extent of that comedians don't challenge themselves. You know, it's just too easy to pick on people who when they're down.
Well, and as a humor worker, if I can use that term, it is
a humor worker. Now that's funny, Sherry.
you're right. It's very easy to punch down. Now, you know, and John is talking about two different things. Novelty can be funny, like, oh my God, did you just say that? But if you're using a joke over and over and it's still working, it's because it's doing another type of work. And in this case, as Carlin suggested, it is reassuring to punch down. It's like you're still on top, and you know, there's no mistake that humor can work to reestablish in someone's mind their supremacy, because I can ridicule you and you can't ridicule me. Punching up. I mean, I've had conversations with white people who were shocked to learn that racial minorities have jokes about them.
Kills the breeze.
And they said, what? I said, oh, no. I mean, you should read more. There are lots and lots of jokes. Because they are intuiting that it's all about power. And humor really often is about power.
Dr. Sherry Parks, it's Midday Culture Connections. Sherry is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and she's also the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. When we come back, you are welcome to join us. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. Before we go to a break, it's our practice each week here on Midday to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City during the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from lists that Ellen Worthing compiles. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list and the victim identifications that are posted on the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far this year, 255 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 6 people were killed. Baltimore police have released the identities of 4 of them. They are Chaz Fox, age 33, Danye Lothar, age 27, Cyrus Beads, age 34, and Donald Cooper. He was 20 years old. We'd also like to note a special art exhibition here in Baltimore that honors the memory of an artist who was raised in Maryland and who graduated from the Maryland Institute College of Art in 1999. His name is Raphael John Sassy, and last spring, he and a woman named Mary Broad were murdered in Commerce City, Colorado. According to the Commerce City Police Department, a suspect has been charged and is awaiting trial. Raphael Sassy was a talented artist who specialized in portraiture. He received a fellowship grant from the New York Foundation for the Arts and a National Portrait Society Award. His work was displayed in New York, in Baltimore, and elsewhere, and it was featured in several national magazines and newspapers. His family lives in Still Pond, Maryland. The memorial exhibition at MICA features a retrospective of Mr. Sassy's work. It opens tonight. It's at the Fox 2 Gallery on the campus of MICA here in Baltimore. The exhibition will be there until Sunday. Raphael Sassy was 42 years old. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about cancel culture and the propensity for backlash against all manner of people and sometimes media. Was Shane Gillis treated fairly by Lauren Michaels and the powers that be at Saturday Night Live? SNL withdrew its job offer to Gillis after racist comments that he made in a podcast last year surfaced on, where else, the internet. The New York Times was pilloried in some circles for a story that hinted at the identity of the whistleblower who is now at the center of the impeachment inquiry. And the new movie The Joker has engendered lots of opposition for its violence. So is this kind of backlash justified? Is it effective at shaming racist behavior and promoting tolerance? In an essay in the New York Times, Loretta Ross, a self-described black feminist, says that call-out culture is toxic. So what do you think? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWIPR. It's Midday Culture Connections. I'm joined here in Studio A by our good friend Dr. Sherry Parks from the Maryland Institute College of Art. So Sherry, we have an email from Blake who says, what about Colbert's vitriol against Trump? So people who are using Trump as an object of scorn and ridicule. What should we think about that?
Well, first I have to admit that I have a soft spot for political humor, so I may be biased. I do think the president is fair game for humor, especially if that humor says something, if it's critique, because it is protected speech. Now, do some humorists go overboard? Do they say things that are ill-advised? Certainly they do, yeah.
Kathy Gifford and her, you know, holding the John the Baptist head of Donald Trump and bloodied and stuff, and she lost a bunch of work, but then she got it back.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that stretches. I mean, clearly she did it for laughs, so I guess it is humor, but I think that stretches the definition.
Yeah, she lost her CNN gig with Anderson Cooper on New Year's Eve. The backlash doesn't come just against comedians. It's interesting that the New York Times, last week as this whistleblower story broke, wrote a story about the whistleblower, and many people thought that it gave enough hints as to this person's job, his or her experience, his or her proximity to the information that he or she shared with the Intelligence Committee and the bosses in the intel community. They said that the New York Times went too far, that they shouldn't have done this because this was going to jeopardize and perhaps even put this person in danger. So there's a backlash against the media for reporting what it knows and what it's been able to verify, because there are some people that say there's a greater good.
Well, and it is a type of public shaming of the New York Times for people who and again, I keep coming back to the culture trying to get back to a normative state. I mean, this is a whistleblower, and he or she is supposed to be protected. And when I read that, I thought, you don't need to do this information. And then the Times came back and said, well, we wanted to establish their credibility. Well, their credibility was established in other ways. So I think in this case, I mean, you talked earlier about mobs, and there is this perception that mobs are always irrational. But there also is the concept of the wisdom of the crowd. And in this case, I think the crowd is correct.
You know, the New York Times, Dean Baquet, who, as you mentioned, said the reason they published was that the president himself and many of his supporters have attacked the credibility of this person. He or she wasn't in the room. You know, this is secondhand information. And so Baquet is saying, you know, we wanted to provide information to readers that allows them to make their own judgments about whether or not he or she is credible.
Well, but the ugly side of backlash, I mean, a lot is ugly to start with, but there's an uglier side. This person's life may be in danger at this point, and I think that has to come first.
Yeah, there are now reports that this person does, in fact, fear for his or her safety. And then there's other reports that Adam Schiff and the House Intelligence Committee is going to be speaking with this whistleblower, and they are trying to figure out through this person's attorney how to do that in a way that conceals the identity of their witness. So yeah, we'll see if that works. Interesting piece by a guy named David Dennis, who's on the faculty of Morehouse College down in Hot Atlanta, Georgia. And he says that cancel culture actually isn't a thing because nobody really truly does get canceled. That, you know, everybody bounces back. They have their moment in the sun, and that moment in the sun, even if it's scorching, can lead to a wide audience, perhaps even wider than the one that he or she began with. Shane Gillis is a perfect example. No one had really heard of Shane Gillis before, the way we'd never heard of almost anybody. We'd never heard of Jimmy Fallon before he was on SNL. We never heard of Eddie Murphy before he was on SNL. Lorne Michaels is in the business for 45 years of discovering people. So he discovers Shane Gillis, offers him a job. This thing comes out, and now all these people at least know who Shane Gillis is.
Well, SNL may be sensitive because they've been accused of not being diverse enough until very recently, and evidently that hit hard. So you know, did your grandfather say if you kick a dog, he'll holler? And in this case, maybe they were a little sensitive. But notice who gets to bounce back. Did Trent Lott bounce back? Not really. Yeah. So I think it depends on what the gig was to start with, whether that person gets
Bob Livingston, the Speaker of the House, you know, exposed as an adulterer.
Right,
you know,
right. So,
although Newt Gingrich also exposed as an adulterer back in the 90s. Well, you know, he's got a job at Fox, at least.
It took him a while.
Yeah.
And you could argue, is he as powerful as he used to be? So I think it depends. But if your job is humor, you may shift audiences. But unfortunately, there is an audience for that.
Loretta Ross writes in the New York Times about a month and a half ago, that she says, and she describes herself as a black feminist. She says, I often have to resist the overwhelming temptation to clap back at people in social media who get on my nerves. And then later in the piece, she has a great turn of phrase. She says, I don't want to do that because I don't want to feed the cannibalistic maw of the cancel culture. She's calling herself out in a way for what actions she has taken in her career as a writer and a professor and a speaker. She's saying this has gone too far. We got to quit this.
And you can see it both ways, because there is a legitimate type of activism where that happens. But particularly when we're talking about, I mean, I'm not nearly as active on social media as I should be, because I just don't want to enter that. And what comes back at Black women is just awful, so much so that there are some Black women who allow other people to clap back for them. There are people who will volunteer to clap back for you. And that's how ugly it's gotten.
She writes about, she says, I've been called out usually for a prejudice I had against someone or for using insensitive language that didn't keep up with the rapidly changing conventions. That's part of everybody's learning curve. Because there are people, I think, who are, if perhaps this is not the perfect word, but somewhat innocently making remarks that certainly, again, this gets back to intention. It's not intended to be demeaning to a particular group. But as it turns out, there are things that you cannot say in 2019 that nobody would have batted an eye about in 1999.
Well, some people batted eyes. It was just whose eyes were batting, mm-hmm. and whether you could say something about it. I mean, and I'm not trying to be oppositional, but I think who is listening and who is responding is really important. And those, we're back to the silences again, where if there was something that you experienced as a microaggression 20 years ago, you didn't say anything. Now you might call that person out, whether that is with humor or just saying, excuse me, I'm sorry, that was offensive to me. That didn't happen 20 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ms. Ross makes the case or makes the point that sometimes when that does happen, the way to do it is privately, rather than, you know, in a Twitter post or something like that. She tells a story at the end of this piece that she said a couple of years ago when she was teaching in Massachusetts, she's a college professor, she accidentally misgendered a student of hers during a lecture. And she said, oh my gosh, she caught herself and said, oh, I felt terrible. And she expected that this student would blast her. But instead the student says, that's okay, I misgender myself sometimes. And she begins the piece saying, we all need this kind of grace. So, I mean, I guess there is some responsibility, some obligation on the part of, you know, people who've been the victims of these microaggressions to just sort of say, well, maybe that's a person's learning curve we're talking about.
Right. And notice that the person didn't let her off the hook, but they didn't punish her either.
Yeah. I mean, and that's different.
There's a subtlety to that that's missing in the public sphere.
We just have a couple seconds left, but I do want to talk about this study that you turned me on to about ridicule in education. You were part of a study that said...
As a researcher, not a...
As a researcher, right. Not as a blatant ridiculer, right. But it tested the proposition that a ridicule is an effective educational corrective. In other words, if you ridicule somebody and call them out on stuff, will they do better in academically? And it worked.
The answer is yes. Particularly with women. Now, notice the study didn't say, and therefore you should do it. But educators ridicule students all the time.
Yeah.
And there's a reason. It's because they actually then turn around and study and do better.
But I suppose you can still do that in a somewhat compassionate and graceful way.
Yes.
Can you? I mean, sounds like you can't have graceful ridicule, but you probably could.
I think it's possible, but it's nuanced.
Yeah,
it's very nuanced.
Very nuanced. As is every conversation you and I have.
Well, thank you.
Good to see you. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Parks from MICA. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives there, and she joins me every month for Midday Culture Connections. Her book is terrific. It's called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, how has the impeachment inquiry changed the game in Washington? Polls are now showing slowly growing numbers of people who support the inquiry, and what can we expect in the weeks to come now that we've realized that people like Rudy Giuliani and Attorney General William Barr and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have also been involved. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find menus and hours at joesquared.com. Com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. And if you're celebrating the Jewish New Year this week, L'Shana Tova. Have a great day.